Heads up, everyone. I'm Alex Runneman with the Heads Up Podcast, and today we're digging back into BIPA, the Biometric Information Privacy Act, as well as GIPA and several other topics that as an organization, whether you're in a certain state or not, may need to be considered. Again, none of this is legal advice, but we were fortunate enough to get Laura Bolson to come on the program. She's the managing partner of the Chicago office of Constanzi, Brooks, Smith & Prophet. And she specializes in work, you know, organizational compliance and state law and federal law. They're in 30 some states across the nation. And she has a lot of firsthand experience with some of the things we're going to talk about today. So I hope you find this interesting and valuable for your organization. Hey, everyone. So although Laura is an attorney, neither of us are giving legal advice today. This is a moment, a topic. Anything we cover is really, it's really important for you to seek your own legal counsel. We may be talking about general things, maybe even specifics, but none of this should be construed as legal advice. That's not what we're about today. But transitioning to that, Laura, I do appreciate you as an attorney and have knowledge of many of the topics we're going to cover today coming on our program today here on Heads Up.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thanks.
Awesome. So, Laura, who is Laura Bolson, and how did you get here? And just share us a little bit of your story. Our listeners love to hear that about the guests we bring on.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm an employer side employment lawyer, which means I help companies try to stay out of trouble and as they navigate all of the many, many federal, state, and local laws that apply to you if you have one employee or 10,000 employees. So a lot of times that means I'm doing advice and counsel work, which is just trying to tell employers, what does the law mean? What do they have to do? What should their policies say? What should they put in writing? What shouldn't they put in writing? And then it also means defending them. So if there's a claim that an employee brings in an agency or in a court, I can take those all the way through trial and have when we have to, but certainly our goal is to try and keep folks out of trial and keep the businesses in compliance as best we can. And I've practiced in Illinois most of my career. Illinois, when I started practicing, it was, I guess, not quite, but coming up on about 20 years ago. Illinois was sort of a, you know, middle of the road state in terms of how many laws employers had to follow and how protective those laws were. And I'd say gradually over that time period, it's really evolved a good bit so that now, you know, California has a sort of reputation as being sort of the most protective of its employees. Illinois is getting pretty close. We've got a lot of kind of, frontline, groundbreaking, you know, very new requirements. And so it really is a challenge if you're operating a business in this state to make sure you're staying on top of it. And, you know, one of the things that I unfortunately have to tell new clients all the time is not knowing about the laws is never a defense. You don't get to say, but I didn't know. Nobody told me. I never received a notice. You know, the government never told me I had to comply with that. That's unfortunately not how it works. It's your obligation to find out what applies to you and make sure you're in compliance.
Yeah, that's right. Ignorance is no excuse to the law, right? Hey, so I think you missed out a couple things. So I just saw, you know, rising star, super lawyer. I mean, you've got some great accolades and some great track record in your career. And I know you're the managing partner out of the Chicago office,
yep.
But you guys are operating in several states though, correct?
Yeah. So Constanzi operates nationwide. We've got something just shy of 30 offices across the country. You know, basically any market that you need help, we have somebody local there. As you said, I am the head of our Chicago office. I actually opened this office about 3 years ago, we've grown a good bit. We've got a good team here that I've brought on, and, we're happy to help clients that are based here. We've also got a number of clients that are based elsewhere and just have employees in Illinois that we, you know, work on stuff for them. Yeah. As far as my own accolades, you know, yes, I've gotten a number of awards and that sort of thing. I'd say don't spend too much time talking about them because it's not that useful to my clients to hear about the plaques I have up on the wall. That doesn't really help them very much.
That's right. But it is an indicator, and I couldn't let it slide by with at least doing a little cheering for you. I know how that works. You don't want to toot your own horn in those cases. So I thought, yeah, we'll do it for you. So you mentioned, and I think it's so well put in terms of Illinois, it almost seems like there is an emphasis to be leading in some of these new employment laws and things. And I think what really got us connected was BIPA, the Biometrics Information Privacy or Protection Act. Privacy Act. Sorry, it's in Illinois. And it's led to some really interesting outcomes and challenges for employers in Illinois, but it also has other, you know, some of our customers and even others in the market and the industry looking at, okay, is our state going to adopt something similar? And other states have copycat legislation and all that. So I would really love to spend a few minutes picking your brain around BIPA, the intentions, the practice, what you've seen from a trial lawyer's perspective, who have maybe seen these things coming through, obviously generally in the court cases, but also what some of your clients have maybe had to engage with this law that operating in Illinois or even potentially in other states.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, the version I usually start with is letting people know BIPA is not actually a new law. It was went into effect 2008, which, you know, now it seems like ages ago. At the time, it was very cutting edge. There were not other places that had laws like this. And essentially, I think one of the things that employers unfortunately have suffered from is it hasn't been updated since that time. So the information that we have now about how the technology works and even the technology itself, right, the things that are available today couldn't have even been contemplated, I think, in 2008. And so it's a broad law that I think hasn't really grown or adjusted as the technology and, you know, our understanding of the technology has changed. But, you know, in very broad strokes, when it was, you know, signed into law and kind of ever since then, what it has said is if anyone, any entity, and so that could be employers, although it doesn't just apply to employers. So it applies to, you know, retailers who are interacting with their customers, really any entity that is collecting biometric information from anybody. And that can be a fingerprint, it could be a scan of your hand geometry, it could be a retina scan, your face geometry. One of the more notable class actions was one against Facebook, and that was related to their facial recognition software for photos that people were uploading on the social media site. So that wasn't, you know, it, for a lot of people's understanding of what do we mean by biometric information, a photograph doesn't usually conjure that. But the issue was the photographs were then being used with a technology that had this facial recognition aspect to it. And so that falls within the purview of this law. So essentially what it says is if any entity is going to collect biometric information from anyone, they have to do a couple of things first, otherwise they can't do it. The one thing is you've got to have a published privacy policy that explains essentially why are you collecting the information? How are you going to use it? How are you going to safeguard it? Things like when does it get destroyed? You know, is there a process for someone to ask for you to destroy it after they're done interacting with you? You know, things like that. And that policy, in addition to being in writing, has got to be accessible to the public. So it's not just something, you know, a lot of employer policies are like in a handbook, for example. That probably is not going to be sufficient. It's got to both be in a handbook and on like a public website generally, right? So you've got to have a written policy. You've got to actually have procedures in place to make sure that the data, the biometric information, is being safeguarded so that it can't, you know, it's got to be treated basically at least as securely as the most confidential other data that the business uses. You know, so whatever steps that business is using to protect things that it considers very sensitive, very highly confidential, you've got to be taking at least that many steps to protect the biometric data.
And yeah, then the secret recipe or the secret sauce, wherever that's held, you better hold all this data too.
That's right. So if it's a double, triple password, you know, encrypted, whatever, that's the same thing you have to do, right? And then the third thing that the law requires, which is often kind of what's getting the most press, is you have to have advance written consent from the person that you're collecting it. And so that one is especially tricky because for an employer that doesn't know about this law, usually the most common scenario this comes up in is especially in like a manufacturing environment, for example. Any place where you have like a time clock and you've got a bunch of employees that have got a clock in and out, right? So you have maybe a long line of employees and there's an inefficiency there. You can see as people are standing, waiting in line for their turn, especially if a shift is turning over and everybody's clocking in at the same time, there's some time being wasted. And so, you know, one technological advancement to help with that is if instead of having to key in like an employee code or find a badge that's on you, if instead you just touch it with your fingerprint and then the machine knows it's you, that's going to really streamline that process. So if you implement a time clock that uses biometrics, before any employee first puts their fingerprint on it, you've got to get that employee's written consent. And if you don't get their written consent ahead of time, if, for example, time clock goes up, you know, maybe everybody's very excited. You had a salesperson probably from the vendor who sold you the time clock that was very excited. Maybe the HR folks were very excited. Probably no one from compliance or legal was involved. And then it goes up on the, you know, factory floor and everybody uses it for a couple of days. And then someone from legal or compliance says, wait a minute, what's that? What's going on? Is that new? What happened? And they say, oh, no, you have to get written consent. And people say, oh, that's fine. Just give us the piece of paper now. It's too late because that's not advanced written consent. You're trying to get written consent after the fact and you've already violated. So the law itself is not super tricky in that, you know, having a policy, having safeguards and getting written consent is not, you know, it's not super onerous. It's just something a lot of businesses don't know about, and then they don't do those things, and then it's not something that once somebody tells you you failed to do it, you can just go fix it after the fact.
I think that's a great point. Many of our listeners are operations-minded folks, and this is just what you said earlier. Sometimes laws don't pass commonsensical judgment, and you think, well, of course, if you're putting your finger on a scanner to log in, you know that your biometric data is being captured, but none of that matters at this point. You have to have that advance consent. You have to have the notice. You have to have it stored and published and all that. I mean, I think that's really that's a hard thing. And I know to your point, this law's been around for a while. But once, you know, a case settles, two cases settle, a case goes to court and gets won, all of a sudden there's a proliferation of suits and issues. And I think this is non-trivial. I think this is significant for certainly employers in Illinois.
Well, and it's a good point in terms of early on, there weren't a lot of lawsuits. So it's not like when this law passed, you know, in 2008, there was a slew of people running the courthouse. For many years, I think it sort of flew under the radar. And then there were several high profile decisions that came out. You know, the Facebook one I already mentioned, there's the Six Flag decision. There have been much more recently, the White Castle decision, a couple of big decisions. And those have put such a spotlight on it from the perspective of how much money there is to be made. And so that's really the key sort of aspect of this Illinois law, which makes it different from all the other states that have since implemented similar things, which is if an employee brings a lawsuit and says, you know, my employer had me give my fingerprint on the time clock and they didn't do these things, any one of those things, maybe they did get the consent, but they didn't have a policy, or they did have a policy, but they didn't get the consent, you know, whatever. They bring the lawsuit, they bring it, they can bring it on a class-wide basis. So they're bringing it on their own behalf and however many employees have also used that time clock. What they're able to recover is $1,000 per violation if it was basically, we tried to comply but didn't, or $5,000 per violation if they can show that you really didn't even try to comply. So in the scenario maybe where the company had no idea this law existed, didn't ask anybody, didn't look into it, that sort of thing. And what has happened just in the past year or so is that the courts have told us what we mean when we say a violation is not each employee. So we don't mean $5,000 per person on the payroll who did this. We mean each time each employee touched that time clock. So that's maybe on a typical day, that's you clock in the morning, you clock out at lunch, you clock back in after lunch, and you clock out at the end of the day. Maybe you're also clocking in and out before and after a couple of breaks. So you have at least four or six times per day, per employee, times $5,000. And that easily adds up to hundreds of thousands, millions, and honestly, sometimes billions of dollars in these lawsuits. And that really, from my perspective, is why this has been such a hot area over the last few years, because you can, if you find the right company, you know, maybe they only have 100 employees, but they've been using these clocks for a year or two or 3 years. That's a multi-million dollar case you just found.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think we've been using the word right here. We're looking into this exponential is how these things add up. And I say it with a smile on my face, but if you're an employer in this situation, it's a nightmare. I can only imagine. So what have you seen? And again, I'll just remind everybody, none of this is legal advice. This is, you know, seek your own counsel. But what have you seen? Not to name a specific company, but, and again, I guess it's so hard because you look at the law, it seems very simple, but who have you seen handle this well? What have they done to really make sure they're safe if they, you know, again, from their legal counsel and all that, what actions have you seen, you know, from an operation perspective, executive perspective, legal HR, whatever aspects you can share with us?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I would say, you know, some of the best things is just trying to do enough research and planning ahead of time before it gets implemented. Because in the scenarios at the organizations where, you know, it's not agree to the time clock, get it hung up, employees are using it, and then go make sure everybody is on board, right? It's before we start using it, you know, maybe we've negotiated the price, maybe we're convinced this is a worthwhile investment, but before we actually say, yes, let's start using it, we're just going to run it past everybody. Like I said, somebody in compliance, somebody legal, you know, somebody who's able to flag this, that makes all the difference in the world, because usually one of those people can, you know, like I said, kind of put the brakes on and say, hold on, before we do that, there's some hoops we have to jump through. And then you've avoided liability altogether. So that's really your best scenarios where you have a, you know, whether it's an HR team or an operations team who are really in communication with these other parts of leadership that maybe they don't feel like need to be brought in, for example, on the decision of does it make sense to have this time clock or not, but have to be advised that this is what we're planning to do. And they have to be advised before you start doing it so that they at least have a window of opportunity where they could say, you know, ordinarily I wouldn't care at all about what kind of time clock you're using, but the one you just described to me, that potentially implicates a lot of really serious liability and risk. And so we need to look into this, see what states we're operating in, see what exactly the laws are, see what our obligations are. So that really is the key, is so many of these lawsuits that have come up that have been just devastating have been because people were just acting too fast. They were just implementing before they had a chance to vet the issue. And, you know, I understand that drive for let's get it done, let's move past it, you know, let's get this out of the way as fast as possible. But the risk associated with that is just so high. And even more so now, because I think, as you mentioned at the beginning, a lot of other states are starting to implement similar laws. And so while Illinois has had this for a while, and we've got a lot of insight into how our courts are going to treat it, every time there's a new law like this in another state, we don't exactly know for a little while, is it going to be exactly the same? Are there slight nuances that are different? And so especially when you have a dispersed workforce, so when you're in multiple states, it's nearly impossible, unless you're studying this all the time, to know what is actually the current up-to-date information about how many other states have a similar law, and is there something else we need to do in those places? So, yeah, I mean, the best thing you can do is just slow down the process enough so that you, whoever it is that's in charge of this kind of risk management, you know, compliance, legal review, whatever it is, has an actual chance to look at it and either say, yeah, I don't have any concerns, or let's look into it before we actually implement that, because there might be something we need to do.
Man, that is a super great point. I mean, I think for organizations, no matter what point they are in the scaling process or whatever, there's this constant notion of, hey, we don't want to slow our decision-making down. We want to be fast and lean and be able to decide with the market, whether it's market pressure or competitive pressure or whatever it may be. But I think what's really important, you really highlighted a nuance there. It's not necessarily that you have to slow down the decision-making process, but at least have a point of collaboration prior to the implementation, right? I mean, I think that's probably great advice for you know, just BIPA, but anything, so that the rest of the organization who are experts in their various areas could maybe find gotchas like this. And to your point, this one is massively risky, certainly in the state of Illinois and potentially elsewhere going forward. So if at this point, you know, again, we could go on, and I think I also want to revisit one point that's important, because again, operational folks are thinking, well, I'm being transparent. They know what I'm doing. I'm in good faith. But I want to go back to one thing you highlighted, which is important. The concept of, okay, I tried, but I still violated the law, and I didn't try at all. And so even in good faith moments or trying to be transparent, that's still going to be a violation of the law if you aren't doing the things you mentioned before. And that's a grand a pop, basically, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, it obviously is better to have the $1,000 per violation sure. than the $5,000. But as I said, when you're talking in the millions of dollars, success. You know, whether it's $1 million or $5 million, usually that's not going to make people feel a lot better about it, you know?
That's right. 6x an employee per day, you know, that's per shift. Yeah, that's a problem. So I think if you're listening and you are confused with this BIPA stuff, I mean, reach out to your legal counsel. This is really important. There are experts out there like Laura and her team. Reach out, figure this out. Also, I guess, you know, again, I think if you're in Illinois, obviously it's danger close, but if you're in another state, or you operate, to your point earlier, multiple states, there are just different laws, and these are going to, I'll guarantee you, there's legislation in many states right now that are being proposed and being considered. Maybe they're in committee, maybe they're on the floor. It's just going to happen. So if you're at home listening, you know, reach out. This is not something you want to let pass by, for sure. What other trends? You know, it's interesting, when we were preparing for this, like I'll jump into one, and I'd love to hear your mind on some other trends. And I may be way ahead on this. Maybe it's not going to be near as big a deal as BIPA was, but I don't know how you pronounce it. GIPA, right? So it's the Genetic Information Privacy Act. Yep. And it's similar in this way, but it's around genetics, where employers using or misusing or using any genetic identifier, whether that be something around a healthcare piece or something in the interview process, could lead to similar challenges like this. Do you have any insight on GIPA or any other trends you see that are happening out there for organizations?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there are some similarities that I think would make it fair to assume the claims under GIPA may end up following a similar path to what BIPA did. One of the similarities is it's not a particularly new law. It's been in effect for several years. Another is it allows for this same kind of class action, you know, lawsuit where basically as long as you find one employee and it's at a big enough employer, you have violations probably because it's because whatever the process is, it's being used not just by one employee, it's being used by the whole, everybody who's in that position, everybody who's ever held that position over the past several years. So you've got nice, good class sizes for lawyers that want to bring class actions. The other thing I think that's similar is GIPA, I think, is catching some employers just unaware. They had no idea they were potentially violating this law. And so, you know, an example is, as you said, it's intended to protect basically genetic information about employees. And the risk or the concern is that you may yourself not currently have an illness, but maybe you have a likelihood of eventually developing the illness because it runs in your family or because there's some, you know, maybe you've gotten genetic testing and you actually know it's in your DNA and it hasn't, right. It hasn't shown up yet. There's no one way in which it's currently impacting you, but it might in the future. And so I think the goal of this law is just to make sure that's not being held against people because there's a benefit to people knowing more about their future health and trying to take steps to, you know, understand that and take preventative, you know, measures and that sort of thing. And so we want to encourage society, say generally, to know about their family medical history. We want to encourage people to get preventative testing. We don't want them to be dissuaded from doing that if they think, well, now my employer can find out about it. And if, for example, I have a marker on one of my genes that says I'm more likely to get cancer later, does that mean I can't get a job because people know I'm going to be a more expensive participant in a group health plan. Yeah, right. And that's why they don't want to hire me, even though I don't have any medical expenses right now. It's just that there's something in my, you know, sort of genetic predisposition that says that may eventually happen, right? So that's the, I think, goal behind the law. The way that it comes up that I think is surprising employers is things like, you know, if you have, for example, a safety sensitive position at your organization, probably there's some amount of screening related to that person's physical abilities. Probably you're using a third-party clinic. That's very common. You have either a doctor's office or a clinic or someplace that does these sorts of, they're essentially kind of fitness for duty or fitness for, you know, the particular role exams. Right. That's very commonplace. Sometimes, even without letting you know that they're doing it, those places will have a fairly detailed questionnaire that they ask everybody to fill out that includes family medical history. So it'll say, has anyone on either your father or your mother's side ever had the following illnesses? And it's, you know, usually like a long checklist of all different kinds of things. And that may not have any relationship to the testing that they're going to do, particularly if the testing, as I said, if it's like, you know, can you lift X number of pounds? And can, you know, do you have this range of motion such that you can safely operate this machine? Neither of those questions is answered by, did your father have heart disease, right? That's irrelevant to it, but it's just part of a standard process that they're using. That process, if they're then asking that information related to the essentially, you know, job offer or the job hiring, could be a violation of this law. Because essentially, you could get information as the employer about this person's family medical history that has no relationship to what you were supposed to be asking about. And if you decide this person's not someone you actually want to work with anymore, then their claim is going to be, you decided not to hire me because you learned about my father's heart disease, not because I failed the, you know, fitness for duty test, not because I couldn't, you know, lift X number of pounds, but it's because you're upset that, you know, if I stay at your company for a while, maybe I'll end up, you know, in the same situation and I'm going to cost too much money on your health insurance. And that's why you didn't hire me. You know, so it's similar in the respect that I have seen employers where they're not even the ones necessarily generating these questionnaires. They may not even know that they're being used, but they're being used as part of the hiring or onboarding process. And it's being used by a vendor of theirs. And the employer is ultimately responsible for that, even if they weren't consulted on it. So even if the vendor didn't specifically come to them and say, this is the paperwork we're going to use, you know, are you comfortable with it or is that okay? you're still responsible for it, because the only reason the employee was asked that information is because you told them you've got to go to this clinic and you've got to complete this process. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to start your job with us.
Yeah. And I think that's really important. I think, with BIPA, that whole term of aggrieved, I mean, you didn't have to do the company didn't have to do anything sinister with their biometric data to be in violation of the law. And I think it's maybe yet for precedent to come out, but it seems like that may have a similar tone in GIPA as well, right? It's not like they're taking your biometric data and selling it to the enemy, right? That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Which is that in both laws, the thing the legislature is trying to do is create protections essentially before an issue arises. So in the genetic information, situation, the employer doesn't have to actually use or rely on that information. It's just if they're collecting it as part of that hiring or that applicant screening process, that violates the law, because the legislature is trying to be, essentially protective of scenarios where it could be a problem later on, which is exactly the same as BIPA, which is they're saying, if you're going to gather this information, it's not as though it's a certainty that you're going to be subject, to some kind of cyber attack, and then that information is going to be exposed. In fact, I think, there's very little examples of biometric data, being kind of what was compromised in some sort of cyber attack. Not that that's not possible, but I don't think that's common. The issue is that what the law says is, whether that's going to happen or not, you have these obligations, and we don't care if ultimately nobody's identity is stolen, you didn't meet those obligations. And that's the thing that violated the law, regardless of what happened with it afterwards.
Yeah, I think that's a really important piece of me. You don't have to be a bad actor here to be on the wrong side of these laws. I guess not that my opinion matters to any lawmakers in Illinois or any other state for that matter, but I love the intent of these laws, the idea of protecting an individual's data and privacy and those things. But these really have some, I think, unintended consequences in the market right now. My question to you, so we've got BIPA, we got GIPA. What else do you see out there? What are maybe some of the top kind of workplace challenges you see with some of your clients that you're having to help them, advise them? And again, everyone, this is not specific legal advice, but just what are you seeing out there that maybe more, may also be interesting and should be on people's radars?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there is an overall trend related to employee monitoring and just how much data or information of all different kinds you're collecting about your employees, So we saw a lot of this, I think, grow in scope when all of a sudden at the beginning of COVID, you had employees working remotely who had never worked remotely before. You had organizations that were not set up for that, who never intended to have remote employees. And a lot of them, have done away with that. A lot of them have accepted some amount of permanent, remote workers, because either the talent that they wanted to hang on to, demanded it, or there was some other efficiency or reason for it. But in any event, with the growth of the remote workforce, I think there's also been a huge growth of employee monitoring when they're outside of the work site, because, managers, HR folks, they want to know, are you really working? What is it you're doing throughout your day? And again, with the changes in technology, it's so easy. You can get so much information, whether it's keystrokes or it's mouse movements or it's, the built-in webcams or the exterior webcams, there's all these points of information that you can be gathering. You can be listening in on every conversation that your employee's having. The difficulty is, if they're having those conversations in their home, and particularly if they don't know that you're listening in, that implicates huge privacy issues, which is, we have things like people who are having conversations with their doctors, with their spouses, all kinds of areas that is clearly protected that the employer has no right to have any knowledge about, but they can because the technology is so prevalent and so easy to do. And likely, if they set it up to do some monitoring, there was initially a business purpose. I haven't seen any examples where an employer is just maliciously saying, I'm just really nosy. I want to know everything that my employees are saying to their spouse, right? Yeah. That's never the goal. But if that's the consequence, if you do end up getting that information, I think that's going to be a huge area of future lawsuits. And there is some legislation already that's been proposed to try and address just that, which is, basically creating a sort of affirmative burden that the employer has if they're tracking work-related, data points like that, to specifically prevent them from accidentally capturing things that are personal and not at all work-related. And those are blurry lines, as I said, especially when you're talking about remote employees. You know, maybe they're doing both at once. Maybe they're on a work call while they are also doing something else personal, and you're capturing both at the same time. So that, I think that's really uncharted territory that we just don't have a lot of clear guidance on. But that's what I would predict is going to be, you know, kind of the trend, because there's a give and take. I really think employees are becoming more aware of these monitoring technologies and they're pushing back on it. And I think employers then, you know, are, I don't know, essentially being pitched, hey, here's new tools that will help you to accomplish jobs. Things you feel like you're not able to accomplish on your own. And there's going to be a real tension there, I think, sorting out where that's supposed to land.
Yeah, that's right. That is a marquee. You know, speaking of uncharted territory, so the latest, greatest buzzword that we've been hearing for the last year plus is AI, right? So I'm curious if you have any perspective on some of the trends. You know, for instance, I say, you know, today we offer, you know, insights and coaching in our applications to our customers that allow those employees, if they so choose, to get insights in terms of their work process and what they can do better and all of that. Fast forward a little bit in the future. I mean, everybody's got, oh, we've got this new AI thing, or they've got AI in their name, or all that stuff, right? But now if I leverage AI to take advantage of all the work product out there and then give you insights, am I really violating the rights of somebody else to use that? I mean, we're seeing it on the scale of authors and illustrators and all of that. Whew, this is talk about uncharted territory. Do you have any thoughts? Are you seeing anything brewing from a legislative standpoint or from a legal protection standpoint?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do have, I think, a number of clients who are trying to stay ahead of that trend to the extent they can and are developing, you know, at least internal policies for their employees about, you know, applications where it would be acceptable to use generative AI programs, and then scenarios where it would not be. And then in the scenarios where you are, where it is okay to use it, what kinds of precautions do you have to take, or what kinds of limitations does the company expect you to take? And I think part of the value of having a policy like that is no one really can assume that their employees know the right way to handle this, you know, in that it's sort of a new experience for everyone. And people are in this kind of experimental phase. You know, they see something online, you know, they want to try it out. It's a new technology. You know, probably employees are potentially taking risks that they wouldn't take in something that wasn't so novel. And so unless you're trying to educate your folks about here, when you're experimenting with those things, or when you're maybe learning about what those tools are, here are the precautions we need you to keep in mind if you're using company information. You know, one of the ones that comes up all the time is there are a lot of these platforms that are either free to use, or if they're not free, you know, it's a fairly nominal, you know, subscription or cost.
Right.
Often what goes along with that is you have no right of, you know, or sort of expectation that your information is not going to be distributed more broadly or accessible to others. Because one of the ways the AI technology learns is by, you know, kind of collecting up what's being submitted to it and then, you know, analyzing that feedback and how you're using it. So just as an example, I know law firms, for example, who are notoriously behind the times on, you know, technology trends, I've been to a number of talks and presentations about how can law firms use generative AI. Well, one of the problems is a lot of the information that law firms get when it's coming from our clients is highly confidential and privileged.
Yeah.
If I share a communication that I have with a client with anybody else, whether I upload it to a platform or I somehow involve someone else, I've just broken my obligations as a lawyer and I jeopardize that privilege. And similarly, if I have a client who's trying to be more efficient with their, you know, note-taking or their file-keeping, and so they're using an AI tool to summarize a conversation they had with me, they've potentially broken privilege by uploading the contents of our conversation. So there's a lot of concerns around whatever information you're inputting. You have to, again, depending on the platform, but you have to kind of assume that's accessible to anyone. And then be, yeah, you know, right. Act as carefully as you would if you knew it was accessible to anyone. So, you know, the other thing that we're seeing too is that a number of those platforms, they have in their terms of service, or they have responded in, say, subpoenas when there's litigation, saying they can provide sort of the history of a user and what questions have been asked and, you know, essentially what the conversations or the results of those conversations have been. And so, again, it just comes around an expectation of privacy is when you're using one of those platforms, you know, some people type in all kinds of crazy things, you know, into their Absolutely. Computers. And if you're typing, you know, I don't don't do any kind of criminal law, but if you're typing, you know, write a, you know, ransom note that would convince someone to give me, you know, $50,000, that's going to be real helpful evidence if you get prosecuted for then, you know, holding up a bank or whatever, right? So that sort of thing, I think, is what people should be thinking about is, where is this information that I'm sharing going? Who has access to it? What might it mean if what I've done on this platform is fully exposed or, you know, shared with some outside party?
It's a great point. I mean, we talk all the time. Things, if we have secret sauce, like I mentioned earlier, you put it into one of those. It's not secret anymore. It's now out in the general populace and available. So it's we are on just the very tip of the iceberg on this whole AI consideration and privacy rights. And hopefully we can find strike balance in legislation that, you know, at least can try to keep up, but also not overwhelm and get the wrong outcomes and all that to come with it. But we shall see. Laura, I one of the things I like to do, I have really appreciated your time, but one of the things I like to do is give our guests the last word. What is it you'd like to tell the listeners?
I mean, I think maybe the overarching point is, if you're running a business, you can't also be keeping up to speed on all of these laws and how they keep changing. You've got to be good at getting good advice from someone whose job it is to do that. You know, just whether you're a small operation or a giant operation, you need to make sure you're getting good advice from somebody who actually has it as their job to track these laws, understand these laws, and figure out how it applies to your business.
That is well put. You know, they say it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to run a company, too, of experts and associates. So Laura Bolson, managing partner of the Chicago office of Constangi, Brooks, Smith & Prophet, I appreciate you coming on the program and offering us some insight here. And maybe we'll bring you back as some of this comes through and we get some more case law around AI and whatnot. But again, thank you and best of the wishes on all that you do going forward.
Thanks, Alex.